Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreenewspodcasts to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussion around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional and individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
There were a couple of crossroad moments, and I either turn left or turn right, and I had the strength of character at the time to turn left. I may come across as this guy that's got it all together. Deep down, I'm deeply flawed in so many wonderful ways, I hope.
That's international best-selling business author Andrew Griffiths, and this is Reframe of Mind.
The podcast that cuts through the platitudes and gets to the core of living authentically, challenging our assumptions and improving mental health with the guidance of good science, philosophy and learning from other people's lived experiences.
And we're your hosts, Louise Poole and Andy Leroy. And last time, we pulled apart the notion of other people's perceptions and their impact on how we value ourselves.
So when you see a book with a title, Someone Has to Be the Most Expensive, Why Not Make It You? By author Andrew Griffiths, it kind of seems very encouraging and something you might like to pick up to, get some quick tips on how to make the dash for cash.
Very enticing. But the layers within Andrew Griffith's book actually contain an exploration of the fundamental value of knowing your own self-worth, which we love.
Yeah, and Andrew's bigger story in the book actually shows us that the worth you think you can charge is directly related to the worth you believe you have.
Yeah. Someone has to be the most expensive. Why not make it you? It's not about getting rich quick or even another self-help book laced with pithy platitudes, because you know how we don't like platitudes in Reframe of Mind. No, Andrew's story actually gives us that chance to ponder the choices that we make in life and how we support ourselves or not in the process.
Now, just a bit of background. Andrew Griffiths has written 14 books and they've been sold in over 65 countries around the world, and he's presented over 750 keynotes, workshops and presentations for a huge range of organisations in 25 countries.
Yep. Clients include everyone from new and aspiring business owners right through to global companies and organisations like the European Union, CBS, Hewlett-Packard, many more. So Andrew Griffiths knows what he's talking about when it comes to business.
Oh, yeah. He's been authoring for over 20 years and, like I said, 14 best-selling books to his name, translated into 10 other languages.
He's officially Australia's number one small business author. He's been an entrepreneur for 35 years.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But this is a mental health podcast, Andy, not a business podcast. So how does Andrew's story fit in the context of looking after our mental health?
I'm glad you asked. Because if anyone had an excuse to fall into a heap over their early childhood experiences and not make a life for themselves, it's Andrew Griffiths. But that's exactly the opposite of what he has done.
Andrew was orphaned as a child. Him and his sister became wards of the state, which is not generally a common recipe for success later in life. So how did he come to own his first business at 18 and go on to be Australia's number one small business author?
That's a big question that overarched our conversation with him about how his life has given him plenty of food for thought and opportunity for growth to share with others.
When I started in business, I had a real poverty mentality. I grew up, had an unusual childhood. I grew up as an orphan, all that kind of stuff, and had a lot of violence and abuse as a child. I didn't have a lot of self-worth. And there's often a bit of a relationship between undercharging or not charging what we're worth, or, small business poverty mentality even, or just a poverty mentality in general, and our upbringing and our childhood and all the rest of it. But when I started to get into business and I bought my first business as a kid, basically, that poverty mentality was really problematic in my business because I never made any money. But I I bought a business off a guy. I bought a dive shop, and the guy who had it before me had a poverty mentality. So his whole thing was about, you got to be cheap. No one's going to buy anything unless you're cheap, 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 cheap. And so I just thought, okay, got to be cheap. He didn't understand things like profit margin, profitability, profit, you know, full stop. Any of the P's he was not particularly good at. And so I had this great business that didn't make any money. And it was only when I had really an intervention from this wonderful friend of mine that everything changed. And I started to understand how important it was to actually charge what you're worth. And most importantly, above that, is that someone in your immediate network or competitors or whatever, someone's got to be the most expensive. Why not make it you? I was 18 at the time. So that then began this incredible, I guess, journey for me, this, you know, 35, 36, 37 year history as a business owner. And I noticed so many people in business are really, really great at what they do, but they just don't charge enough for it. They just don't charge what they're worth, to the point where there are people that can actually never make a profit in their business because they simply don't charge enough. Now, that sounds kind of absurd, but I encounter people like that ridiculously frequently. And I go, if I look at your business, you can never make money, yet you're working yourself to death because you just don't charge what you're worth. So what I'm trying to say there is that this is an issue that I see. I've seen for a long time in business. I've experienced it myself. So this undercharging, not charging what you're worth. So the opposite of this is obviously saying, well, okay, then, you know, you've got to start charging what you're worth. And the pinnacle of this is to be the most expensive at what you do, because there's a lot of good reasons to be the most expensive.
Andrew wrote his first book, 101 Ways to Market Your Business, in 1999.
A lot of what you're talking about reminds me of some things I came across when I was over the years of self-development courses that I've been in and out of. And one particular teacher that I had used to talk about the concept of the map not being in the territory. So the analogy is that, you know, if you had a Melways that was 25 years old and tried to get around Melbourne with it today, it wouldn't be a fair representation of Melbourne as it is today. So you probably wouldn't get very far, or, you know, in certain parts of the city that probably didn't exist back then as well. But I wonder, though, Andrew, how your map looks today as author of book number 14 compared to how it looked when you were writing book number one.
Oh, completely different, Andy, completely different. Well, for starters, when I wrote book number one, I didn't think anyone would read it. So there wasn't a whole lot of pressure. Like, it was like, well, you know, I was amazed that it was published. I'm still amazed that it was published. And really, I wrote my first book it was really a time management tool more than anything else, because my little business, I was running a marketing company, and I was getting all of these small business owners coming to me wanting advice, but none of them had any money. You know, I was attracting the wrong kind of clients. And so, like, literally, I'd spend all day long talking to people and offering advice, but not getting paid for it. So I was basically running a not-for-profit. And most small business owners can relate to that. But I was getting asked the same questions all the time. So I wrote fact sheets and put them on the wall in the office so that if people wanted to know how to do a sales call or how to make a brochure or how to, you know, how to make their invoice, how to get paid quicker, whatever it might be. And literally one day I had like 50 of these fact sheets on the wall, and people could come in, or we would fax them back then out to people. I just thought, wow, these are great. These are really saving me time now. People can just come in and access these. And that's when I just had the idea, if I wrote another 50, I could put them together in a book, and bang, there'd be 100 of these ideas. And that's when 101 Ways to Market Your Business came from. And I was lucky and it got published. And, you know, that was the beginning of my writing kind of world. But you're so right. Back then, I mean, one of the biggest concerns to me was this book all of a sudden was at airports and in shops, and it sold a huge number. Was now all of a sudden I was the marketing expert. And I'm running a tiny little marketing company in Cairns, middle of nowhere, kind of going, no, I'm not. I'm not. I haven't got any marketing qualifications. I'm a street smart marketer. I'm like, you know, like Sesame Street, not even, you know, Pitt Street. And so for me, it was like, oh my God, people are like Telstras of the world, and these big companies are ringing me saying, we'd like you to do a tour around Australia. And my first big speaking job was like 35 cities in Australia. And I'm going, really? I felt unbelievable imposter syndrome. But what kind of changed it for me was, it was actually tearing me apart, because I felt like a total fraud. Like, who am I? Like, I've got no marketing. I run a little marketing company. I had all of the reasons not to believe. And then I started to go, okay, well, hang on, though. The reality is, I've got really great results for my clients. They love me. The people who I do work for, you know, keep coming back and really loyal. I'm not trying to say I've got all the answers. What I'm actually trying to say is, hey, I did this stuff with my clients and it worked. This might help you in your small business.
When you were writing those fact sheets for people, was that all information that seemed really obvious to you?
Completely obvious.
I'm wondering how much we actually undervalue the knowledge that we have, because it obviously wasn't obvious to everybody else.
We undervalue it enormously. And that's, I teach people to write books. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks that I have, apart from this imposter syndrome that everyone has to a large degree, and those people who don't have it should have it.
they probably needed it.
They needed it, right? But is that, well, but you know, people say to me all the time, but surely everyone knows this stuff. And that's whether I'm talking to someone about financial planning or an engineer or a lawyer even, or even, you know, people with a high level of skills, professional skills, really struggle with that concept of surely everyone knows this. You know, even with my books, when I first had that idea to turn that into a book, that first one, I sent it out to a few of my marketing friends as an idea, saying, hey, I'm thinking about writing a book about this, about how to market your business. And even they came back to me and said, Andrew, you're a nice bloke and all, but you know, who are you to write a book? And then when it got published by Allen & Unwin, I sent them all a copy. And everyone came back to me. It's passive aggressive, yeah, but, you know. And I sent it back saying, here's the book that you said I shouldn't write. And they all came back to me, all of them, and said, you know what? I could have written this book. And I very kindly said, yeah, but you didn't. You know, and it's a lot about, everyone has got problems. Everyone's got all these issues. We all want stuff solved. And there's this hunger. We're looking for people to say, well, how did you solve yours? You know, how did you lose weight? How did you have a better relationship? How did you get healthier? How did you do this? How did you do that? How did you grow your small business? So, Louise, it's a great point. The stuff that you figured out and you've learnt, and you know, the mistakes you've made that have, you know, the stuff you've got right, all of those things all rolled together put you right in this spot. And I say that no one on the planet has the same experiences, realizations, aha moments, bazinga moments, you know, war wounds, whatever it might be, as you. You know, and that's the, we've all figured stuff out, and there's value in the stuff that we figured out. And once you appreciate the value in the stuff that you figured out, that's when things start to change. My entire business is about teaching other people the stuff that I figured out.
I was thinking the imposter syndrome. Oh. How are we going to overcome that? Because I think that's what holds a lot of us back, is that, yes, we have the skills. Yes, we are the best at what we do. But somewhere in there, maybe someone along the line has told us that we're not worth that because it serves their own self-interest. And we believe it. We believe that about ourselves, that, you know, we don't deserve these things.
And it's a really important point, isn't it? Because, I get that. I hear that myself. And I look at that and say, okay, so, you know, we make the commitment, and that's the key to what you're saying, is that you can't just go from being the cheapest to being the most expensive without some form of change. I say in my book, you can't put lipstick on a wombat, you know. Like,
sexy if you did.
It'd be a very cute wombat, you know, but I'm sure the wombat's not going to like it. So, again, there's a few kind of weird elements in here. And I have so many stories that I could share about that. It's more a matter of, we've got to say, okay, well, we've got to make that mental kind of commitment to increase our prices or be the most expensive. We understand that. Then we've got to say, well, okay, do we really offer, you know, a great level of service? Do we really have a great product? Do we really, you know, like, are we justifying? You can't just put up your price and not deliver. And that's this whole point about, we live in a value-driven world more than anything else nowadays. So there's a little bit of that shift, but we've also got to look back and go, okay, well, am I really basing my thinking on old information? like, I'm not good enough, I'm, you know, can't charge enough, you know, this is that old stuff in the past.
Mm.
When you're good at what you do, you really should have had a whole pile of kind of feedback where you reach a point where you there's enough evidence to suggest that you're good at what you do. You know, I've had that as a speaker. For me, when I started out speaking, you know, I needed people to come up to me at the end of a presentation and go, oh my God, you're amazing. I needed that. My bucket needed to be filled with enough of that kind of praise because of my self-worth issues at the time. But then I reached a stage where I didn't need that. I didn't need that feedback at the end of it because I knew that I was good at what I did. I knew I did a lot of work. I put a lot of energy into my speaking, my writing, my books, etc. I don't need people to say my books are great. I appreciate it. I really value it. But I'm really confident in my information because I've had enough feedback from others along the way. So that's kind of one element. Mm. The second part is we've really got to be able to benchmark ourselves and go, well, okay, so how do we know that what we're doing is better than others? How do we know that our level of service is better, our products, etc.? I mean, many, many years ago, one of the few times in my life when I've had an actual real job, I was selling cruises on the Great Barrier Reef. And there were three of us in this space. And the first thing that I had to do when I started that job was I went out on our cruise ships, then I went out on the two competitors' cruise ships. And it soon became very clear that we were not the best. And it soon became very clear who was the best. And that's why they charged the most. We were the cheapest. And actually, that was kind of right because, to be honest, we were pretty crap at what we did, you know. And if we try to sell ourselves as the Rolls Royce of cruisers on the Great Barrier Reef, it wouldn't have worked because we weren't.
Mm.
But it was really interesting, and I think about that experience often because it really did show me why were these guys the best? Because everything they did worked. They went to a great part of their reef. Their boats were better than our boats. Their crew were better than our crew. Their lunch was better than our lunch. Their toilets were cleaner than our toilets. Their coaches were not. You know, they did everything well, which meant they could charge an extra 30% on that. And so, Louise, I guess the answer to the question there is when the demon kind of raises its head, that imposter syndrome one, we've got to look back at history. What are people telling us? We've got to do some market research to say, well, you know, if we're going to make this claim that we're the best, how are we actually the best?
Mm.
How do I know? You know, you got a little bit of research on that, and you got to make sure that you're really, you know, really deeply engaged with your clients, customers, whatever they might be, to make sure that you're getting this really constant feedback, not about, oh my God, you're awesome, but you're delivering what they need, you know, you're delivering value, you're staying relevant with them.
In getting through this mindset change from this poverty way of thinking into something that's going to be sustainable and actually going to be more beneficial financially, how do we make that shift without falling into those, you know, old modes of self-talk that say, look, you're just fooling yourself, you're dreaming too big. If you just plan smaller, then things might grow, but if you plan too big, going too big and too wild, then you're just fooling yourself, you'll never work.
So the way that I look at this is that there's a couple of things that where your business is at right now, for example. I think most people actually, if I said, do you think you really charge enough for what it is you do? Most people tend to say no, right? They get that. To make the leap to becoming the most expensive is without, that's a big leap. And often it's a little bit outside of people's comfort zone. So people go, oh, look, we definitely like to be able to charge more for what it is that we do. So you're somewhere on that sliding scale, wherever you are now, compared to being the most expensive, there's a whole pile of kind of stuff in between. So where I start with, so whether you just want to put your prices up a bit or you do want to become the best, there's things that we need to perhaps understand and there's things that we need to look at a little bit differently. First and foremost, the thing is that if you're in that space where you're, you know, perhaps driven by price and you believe that you're in a price-driven market, I really don't think we are. I think we're in a value-driven market. And I think that people understand value and they understand that you get what you pay for. Nothing new in that. I mean, Benjamin Franklin, you know, issued, you know, quotes around that kind of concept a couple hundred years ago. So people are looking for value and they're prepared to pay for it. And they can actually track you down now and find you. So if you become the best at what you do and all that that entails, which by association would mean that you can charge the most, there are people out there that will find you. But the problem is, And I just literally had a coaching call with a lady at the moment. Her current clients are all price driven, right? So they're all kind of, you know, they're cheap. Cheap attracts cheap. So she wants to break out of that mold, but the reality is to start charging more for what it is she is doing, she's probably going to lose a lot of her clients that she's got now because they don't want to pay more, right? And that's part of this journey is we got to say, okay, if we're going to really change our business model, and I'm really encouraging people to do that, you got to say, well, you got to be prepared to lose some stuff. And you're going to lose those clients that you probably shouldn't have. You know, you're going to probably lose some staff members who can't kind of deal with being able to kind of having a model that's a little bit more complicated, as in we don't just sell stuff because we're the cheapest. We sell stuff because we deliver quality. You're going to probably have to battle with your own internal demons and the stories that we tell ourselves. My clients can't afford it. The market's down. The this, the that, the other. So I spent half of my time, you know, really kind of trying to help people to navigate through the fact versus the fiction of this increasing your price model.
I think for me personally, where I sit is kind of in that middle zone. I mean, the feedback that I've had certainly in my career has been successful. You know, that praise is there, that recognition is there, but it's kind of in transitioning from having worked for someone else. You know, Yeah, it's different. So yes, I, you know, was a success with this, you know, number one rated morning host for, you know, 8+ years and all that jazz. People love me. Everyone says, oh, you're my favorite interviewer ever. But now that I have my own business, it's putting yourself forward. So I can no longer hide behind an employer if something doesn't work out. Is there a tip for making that mindset? Like when you know you have the skills and... I don't have the self-doubt in my ability to do things.
Yeah. For starters, this is really, really common and really, really normal. And I hear this a lot from people that, you know, when I was in my corporate life or working for someone else and I had the brand, right? I had that. I'm a part of that. All of a sudden, when it's little old me and I'm the product without that, you know, that behind me, there's a sense of vulnerability. Like, you
yes,
know,
that's
all,
it.
All of the reasons you go, well, hang on, I'm just as good as I was back then. What's changed? I haven't got this overarching kind of empire behind me that is kind of my credibility piece. So what it is this kind of redefining who you are, and it's redefining that credibility, right, but behind yourself. It's like when you go, okay, I start my business today, we get our first client. And it's like, okay, well, so what's your criteria for clients? Anyone who will pay me. It's a very, very exhaustive and thorough kind of screening process. Have credit card, you're my new client, right? And you know what it's like.
Yeah.
When you're starting out in business, you sometimes pick the wrong clients, right? You have people that you do work for that doesn't end well, and it's like, oh, my God, what was I thinking? I didn't know. Look, you got to go through that stage a little bit when you're starting out. You got to make mistakes. You got to get things wrong, you know? You got to lose some money. You got to go, well, that cost us a whole pile of money and I didn't get that right. That's what being in business is all about. But the same thing comes along. You've got to just say, you got to be measuring your successes as you go. One really simple little thing that I, again, encourage my clients to do is have a success board. Simplest of things. Every year in January, wipe it clean, and then throughout the year, just put your successes. What did we do really well this year? Whatever they are, personal, business, etc. Take a photo of it at the end of the year, and then, you know, wipe the board clean and start again. We forget most of the stuff that we get right. We remember and beat ourselves up on the stuff that we get wrong. All right, we remember that one project that we kind of buggered up, or that one client that was really difficult. You know, rah rah, it didn't kind of work out, but we forget about all of the stuff that we got right. So over time, if we start to realize, well, you know what, this is what people are saying. This is what people are, you know, I'm getting referred more work. Now, you don't get referred work if you're crap at what you do, right? You start to get more of that stuff. And if we sat down and I said, okay, Louise, how much of your work is word of mouth referral? I would say a lot of it, right? Because you're straight away, What does that tell you? That you're good at what you do.
Mm.
There's people who value you. You start looking at your projects that have successful outcomes. You start looking at when you finish a project and you leave, the client's really happy. You know, everyone, there's a really positive end to it. People keep coming back to you to get other stuff done, etc. You start to get enough of that feedback if you're open-minded to it, as in you don't dismiss it without kind of absorbing it. You know, like Andrew recommended, you know, Mary come and see me. Oh, that's really nice of Andrew. But think about what that means for Andrew to recommend, you know, someone to you. Think about the level of trust. Think about their confidence in you. We don't recommend people to stuff that we don't believe in. You know, we just got to have more of that kind of thinking, which says, you know what? I'm getting enough feedback to say that I'm good at what I do. And over time, you start to believe it. It's called, like, you know, in the beginning, it's just business owner's bluff. where we go, oh my God, I'm super successful. Yeah, I'm going to buy a Maserati next week. You know, and you kind of haven't got enough money in the bank account to actually put petrol in a Maserati, let alone buy a Maserati. But you tend to have a bit of bluff. That's what being an entrepreneur is all about. But over time, you do get more confidence in what it is that you deliver.
Yeah.
And that confidence then starts to make you appreciate your worth and your value more and more.
When you were showing that book to those colleagues, your marketing friends, and they didn't believe in you. I mean, I think a lot of people in business can really relate hard to that, because you tell someone your idea and they're like, oh, someone else is already doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Or oh, that's a terrible idea. How do you not let other people's negative mindset get in your way? Because it can be very easy to take on other people's opinions.
I find spite is a really good tool. You know, for me, because of growing up, you know, my line that I use for that is I spent the first 18 years of my life being told that I was worthless, and the rest of my life proving that I wasn't. And I learned at a very young age to believe in myself and to back myself. I made so many mistakes, it's ridiculous, of course. But I've learnt the importance of being my own person and backing myself. And I perhaps learnt to not to wallow when I get things wrong, and to go forth blindly. And if that doesn't work, well, I'm going to try something else. And actually, ironically, it kind of ties back into this concept of curiosity.
Mm.
You know, like, okay, I'll try stuff, and 8 out of 10 things that I try might not work, but the 2 that work really, really well. And I think that the other part about that is that I would say is so vitally important in business is to have far fewer people around you who tell you and who take great pleasure in telling you all the things that they don't think you can do. Because I certainly have had those people in my life. However, I've had far more people who believe in me and tell me, you know what, if anyone can do it, you can do it, Andrew. You know, that look, I've got an idea. But it's not just a blind, yay, everything will be great if you do it. It's like they know me and know that I will make things happen. You know, it's the old, one of the most important parts of being successful in business is having the right peer group. And I know we've all heard that. And sometimes it's hard to find that peer group. But you've got to have people around you who their number one concern is your well-being and and they're able to disassociate their own limiting beliefs to give you advice. It's like, again, when I'm helping someone to write a book and they say, should I show my partner my draft manuscript? And I go, for the love of God, don't.
Yeah.
You know? No.
We thought we were the only ones who came up with the idea of not showing our partners things.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Your partners are there to be loved and adored, not to read your draft manuscript of your book.
We made the mistake of playing them a podcast episode, and they're like, you talk a bit fast.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. But they complimented the other person's partner, so you know, it all balanced out.
Awesome. Yeah, great. Thank you very much. Love you dearly. Hope you die. You know, like, yeah, those things. But it is a... part of it for me has always been, I guess, a drive to try and not so much to prove others wrong, even though I said that about the value side of things. But, you know, I think, for me, to be successful in business, it has always been a battle or a competition against myself not against others. I'm not trying to be more successful than someone else, or I don't get envious of someone who's, you know, built Tesla, for example, or whatever it is like that, you know. And I think that comes back to, again, having the right people around, knowing your own value set, being okay with what it is. Like, I don't need to have all of the answers, but I know what works for me, and I'm really helpful to share that with others. That kind of stuff, I guess, it is an evolution of over time. Perhaps getting to know yourself better and perhaps being more at peace with who you are. I think that that's something I've certainly developed a lot more of as I've got older.
I'm curious, Andrew. I hear a lot of people in small business saying that it's really hard. I work so many hours, it's hardly worth it. You work, you know, 24 hours, not 24 hours a day, but you get the idea of what they're saying with that mindset. And I wonder, you know, do we need to sort of look at ways with work-life balance of, as small business people, not necessarily separating business from leisure, but maybe integrating it? Or do we need to take a step further back and look at the values behind of the decisions we make?
It's a big thing. I wrote a book about this, 101 Ways to Have a Business and a Life. And I tell people it's my first work of fiction. And I don't believe it now. I wrote it at the height of the work-life balance kind of phase, I would call it. And I look back at it and I go, yeah, okay, it's the cute idea. I don't know if it really works. There's a whole pile of reasons, again, when that whole, you know, you're working and it seems hardly worth it. That's actually a big part of the reason I wrote that book as well, right? Because all these people are working themselves to death. The reason that they are is simply because they don't charge enough for what it is that they do. So straight away, there's that tangled web that kind of, you know, entails. But, you know, the sheer nature of business is, you know, those people who are successful in business, there is a degree of obsession. You know, it's like the famous chef, the successful chef, doesn't become a successful chef by working 8 hours a day. It's just such a different psyche when you run your own business. It becomes a part of your lifestyle. It's not a Monday to Friday thing. It's not something that you generally switch off from. And the reality is that it is most definitely not suited for everyone. And there are a lot of people in small business that probably shouldn't be. And that's just a bit harsh, but it's the truth of it. You've got to be okay with uncertainty. You don't have a pay packet each week. You guys know what it's like, right? You don't know at times. In COVID comes along, there's no redundancy payment. There's no guarantee of anything. This uncertainty that we have to be comfortable with as business owners, for many people, they could not live with that degree of uncertainty. Whereas I look at it now, I kind of find it a bit exciting. I'm that used to it, it doesn't really matter. If you tie that back into saying, well, you've got to work a lot of hours and it's going to, you know, be kind of, you know, overtake your life a bit, absolutely. But hopefully, you're going to get to that point in your business where you go, you know what, I don't need to actually work as many hours. Now I've got to break the habit, because often we end up working ridiculous hours, not because we need to, but just out of habit. You know, I got into working 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, because I had bad habits, not because I really needed to. You know, I wasn't as productive. I started working on a Saturday, so I'd put stuff off till Saturday. You know, then I started working on a Sunday, so I'd put stuff off to Saturday and Sunday because I was coming in anyway, and I'd spend Monday to Friday farting around, wasting time, not kind of doing it. And I also think sometimes there's a bit of the small business owner's badge of honour. There's a bit of misery associated with it, kind of working like a dog. I've got to do this, I've got to do that. You go, well, I don't really know that you need to do that all of the time. There's periods where we have to. Absolutely, that comes with the territory of owning your own business. But ultimately, you've got to build the business to suit you, and that takes conscious effort and say, well, okay, if you want to work 4 days a week and you want to earn 200 grand a year, okay, well, that gives you a bit of a goal in terms of what it is you need to be earning in your business to make that happen. Then you've got to say, well, am I dealing with fact, or am I dealing with reality, or am I dealing with fiction? So the whole concept of, you know, rethinking it and, you know, maybe changing how we run our business, you know, that is everything from what we charge to who our customers are to what our business actually looks like. I mean, I got caught up in growing a bigger business. You know, I had 15 staff, all the rest of it. I didn't make any money. I mean, I had to get to 100 grand each month before we started making a profit. And it was like, okay, so 28th of the month and we're at 98 grand. So we might, you know, it was stressful. And I realized I'm not actually very, I don't like this. I'm not doing the work that I enjoy. I started making money when I downsized the business to 3 staff. That's when I made money. That's when I had a life. That's when I got back to it. So sometimes we've got a business that doesn't actually fit what we want in our lifestyle. And so I'll have someone say to me, oh, look, I've got my superannuation payout. I'm going to buy a little cafe because that's going to be an easy lifestyle. you know what? The best thing is to just get a hammer and hit yourself between the eyes 3 or 4 times a day and then burn a whole pile of money and just get it all over and done within the first half an hour. There was a spate of people with superannuation wanting to buy motels, move to the country and have a relaxing lifestyle running a motel. And I'm going, have you got any idea what is involved in running a motel? Like, you know, like again, poke your eyes out with a blunt stick. It'll be less painful than you know, what's involved in running something like that. So sometimes there's a bit of the fantasy of what a small business might be as opposed to the reality as well.
I'm going to do a little circuit breaker here and say thanks for listening to us. If you love the show, let us know. Hit the subscribe button on your podcast app and show us those 5-star ratings. Remember to tell your friends about us and check our Patreon page for access to even more content like extended interviews at patreon.com/reframeofmind. The more people we get talking about mental health, the more supported we'll all be.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 sync meetings, you spent 56 minutes searching for files and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes! 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite show? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreelifestyle to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
How did you get comfortable with that uncertainty? Was there a tipping moment that you recognized that it didn't bother you anymore?
I think I started to look at it more as excitement. People ask me, you know, why have I been in small business for so long? You know, part of it is the freedom. I like to be my own boss. The other part is I'm probably unemployable. The third part about that is I never quite know what today is going to bring. I never quite know what my email is going to have when I open it up. I never quite know who I'm going to meet or what my experience will be like or whatever. And so that uncertainty for me, whereas it used to be a sense of uncomfortableness and freaking out, now I kind of look at it and go, well, actually, I kind of find it exciting. I kind of find that. And I think I had to consciously change my thinking as well, because it's kind of stressful to always be freaking out and not knowing and not, you know, uncertainty. Whereas I think another part of that kind of shines through is that, you know, I know how much I've turned over every month for the last 15, 20 years. So it's pretty unlikely that tomorrow I'm going to turn over 1/10 of that. So like we were talking about with confidence and all the rest of it, I've got enough evidence behind me to probably give me a sense of security as well. You know, that I know that, you know, in January I probably turn over, I don't know, 50 grand or whatever it's going to be. And most Januaries, that's what I turn over. So over time in business, you start to get a little bit more of familiarity and I guess reassurance that probably I didn't have in the earlier days.
I think your story from early on in your life is moving, and I think that it's also something where you could have chosen to be a victim. It's rough, the things that happen to you, but you've chosen not to. And, I mean, that's incredible. How did you get to that point?
I get asked this question a lot. People say, why aren't you pulling wings off butterflies and you know, hurting puppies and things like that? I kind of have a couple of different takes on that. I mean, it's a hard when you have an upbringing, particularly there was no certainty. I mean, I didn't, you know, obviously was brought up as an orphan. I lived in and out of state care, lived with a crazy old lady. I slept on a mattress in a backyard for the first 10 years of my life. Incredible violence and neglect and all that kind of stuff. And I did go down a very predictable path of alcohol and drugs and stealing cars. And, you know, it was a very clear path because, you know, that's what fitted. That's what fitted that kind of life. That's who you hung out with. That's who, you know, bad people accept other people's bad behavior. You know, a friend of mine who was a heroin addict for 20 years said the hardest reason to stop being a heroin addict is not to give up heroin. It's just that I need to lose all of my friends who are heroin addicts. Mm. And the problem is that they all accept my horrendous behavior because they're the same. And you're totally unconditionally accepted by other heroin addicts because they get it. So he said, if I didn't have those people in my life, how would I survive? So I went down that predictable path, but then part of it for me, I think, was I am a very much an optimist. Even throughout all of that, I never really felt like a victim. I didn't know any alternative. It's just that's what my life was like. And even I remember once I went to a friend of mine's place, like where I lived with this crazy old lady. We had a Christmas tree up all year round, and like, I just thought that was the norm. I remember going to a friend of mine's place, and it was like middle of the year or something, and they didn't have a Christmas tree. And I said, "Oh, where's your Christmas tree?" And he said, "Oh, we only put it up at Christmas." I went, "Oh, that's a shame. Don't worry. You know, things will get better." And it's all a matter of your perspective, right? Yeah. Your you know, how it is. So part of me, I think, was inherently optimistic, and I think that I do have an optimism gene. And my sister, sadly, she didn't, and she died at a young age. Mm. And it was like, she didn't have that optimism. No matter how hard she tried, it just kind of beat her.
Yeah.
And so I was optimistic. But the other part of it for me was that I was very fortunate in there were a couple of crossroad moments, and I either turned left or turned right. And I had the strength of character at the time to turn left. And they were very pivotal moments, you know, like get in this car right now with these guys and go, or go inside, grab your bag and get the hell out of there. And I had a few of those moments early on that helped me, you know, break away from that life. And that really set the scene for me for the rest of my life in terms of kind of being my own man and, you know, and a lifetime of trying to become a better person and, and letting go of stuff, you know. People hang on to so much crap for so long. I mean, I see people that are 80 that hang on to stuff that happened to them at 15. And you go, I get it was horrible. I'm not trying to take away from the horrible nature of it, but you've been a prisoner to what happened to you when you were 15 for 65 years. You know, that situation, one and one and one and one, you got to let go of stuff. Easy for me to say, I get it, you know, and I'm not trying to have a pity competition and levels of stuff. But if I hung on to every bad thing that happened, every horrible thing that another human being had done to me, like seriously, I would have been dead ages ago simply because it would have eaten me up and destroyed me from the inside out. And I learned at that fortunate young age, I have to let stuff go.
Mm.
What do you think has helped you to make better decisions through life?
I think having a really clear value set, Andy. I know what my values are. I know what I will do and I won't do, and I'm really clear on my own integrity. And you know, that's sometimes hard for other people because they'll say, "Man, you're hard to be with because you know your expectations are so high of how people should act." And that's, you know, I'm toughest on myself for that. I have a really high value set, and I don't really know where that came from. I think it was from seeing the opposite of that in life at an early age. I think I don't want to be that guy that beats up women. I don't want to be that guy that steals stuff. I don't want to be that guy that's, you know, smokes heroin, steals cars. You know, like the path that I was going on, I guess I decided I wanted to be the opposite of all of those things that I actually hated and rejected. So, I think having that clarity of value was really helpful for me. I think the second part of that, though, is when I was that age, when I was 17 or 18, I think, you know, I looked at life as everything was so black and white, And in the middle was this tiny little grey area. You know, it's either right or wrong, and there's this little kind of grey area. What I realise now at 55 is there's this giant grey area and a little bit of black and a little bit of white on either end. And I think that has probably, as much as I hold myself to a really high value set, I really appreciate and respect and understand that how other people are and being okay and knowing that it's, you know, just because I'm like that doesn't mean everyone is like that or everyone, I should expect that of everyone else. So I've learned to be a lot more understanding and accommodating and realizing that the black and whites, you know, the black and white absolutes don't translate a lot when you are thinking about how others are. And, you know, like this whole thing we're going through at the moment, you're either, you know, a tin hat foil wearer or not. I'm going to dislike that person. Now, I might have known him for 20 years, but because I disagree with them about vaccine and they're not going to be my friend anymore, I go, I don't want to be like that. I just want to go back to that stage of being able to still love someone and be able to disagree with them, you know, and you know, or disagree with them and still love them. I guess over the years, this constant mission to just become a better version of myself. I mean, it's a bit of a cliched answer, but it's really true. You know, every Friday morning, 10 o'clock, I ask myself a simple question. How am I better as a man this week than I was last week? You know, and some weeks I am, and some weeks I'm probably not. You know, but I want to ask myself, and I ask myself, how is my business better this week than it was last week? You know, that constant effort to try and be that better version of myself is only a competition I'm having with myself. It's not there's no one else involved in it. It's just me that I'm trying to be that better version of myself. And I don't know, you know, I hope it's working.
I like that idea of, you know, being able to just simply be able to disagree with people and retain that friendship, retain that relationship. What if that turns in the direction where their behaviour starts to become abusive or unacceptable?
Great point. Well, look, I've had that experience. I met my father when I was in my, 23 or something like that. So I didn't know he was alive. I thought my mother and my father were dead. When I was running my own business, it was pretty successful. Then I turned it around and I met him, and it was, you know, I had the phone call, you know, Andrew, I'm your father, kind of phone call. Very, very Darth Vader-ish, I might add. And you know, we met up and all the rest of it. And I, you know, I learned very, very quickly that this chap, really what he wanted was money. Yeah. You know, I mean, I picked him up at the airport, and on the way from the airport to my place, he borrowed $200 off me. And it was like, well, okay. So we're under the guise of, you know, he didn't have his card. I didn't really care. Who cares? I'm meeting my dad, you know. It was like amazing. And I held him in this high level, oh my God, kind of, you know, status, because you idolize, you know, your parents when you haven't had them around. You assume that they are amazing. And anyway, it was very clear very soon that he was about money, and he was an alcoholic, raging alcoholic. And so I literally, within, I think, 2 days, said, look, I'm however old I am, 25 or something like that, you know, I don't need an alcoholic in my life at the moment. If you want to have some kind of relationship with me, that's fine, but I'm only going to do it with you if you're sober. And I never heard from him again. And to be honest, I haven't lost a moment's sleep over that. You know, I mean, I didn't need a drunken alcoholic father at that age. I would have liked to have had a relationship with him, sure, but I didn't need someone like that in my life at the time. So, and people have said to me, oh, but he's your father and you should and you should do that. And you go, I don't think so. You know, I don't think so. I gave him a choice. You know, it wasn't for me at that stage. And that's what I mean by this high moral value thing. You know, it can be, you know, not easy for everyone, but I knew what I wanted in my life and I knew what I didn't want. And that's that example for me that, you know, I'll be supportive, of course, of people, and I would kind of, you know, do what I can, but I also, you know, I have a very low tolerance level for bad behavior, you know, or people not, you know, perhaps treating me how I would want to be treated or treating with respect, and I would expect them to hold me the same way. Yeah, it's an interesting one.
I often think that the things that we've experienced, like those kind of extremes, you know, like especially from parental behaviour, where perhaps they've been cruel or mean, I sometimes think that that's driven me too to like, I wouldn't be who I am if not for, or I suppose in spite of, to prove that I'm different than that. Mm. And I get, I feel like I get that from your story too, like that your values are so strong, you know, particularly with things like wanting to spread kindness in the world, because you've so, I mean, so completely understand what it's like to not have kindness.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And also, I don't know, you've got to find ways to reframe things,
yeah.
I think, to come to terms. I had this amazing experience. I've never met my mother, and, you know, I wouldn't know if I walked down the street. And I've got one kind of old photo of her when she was a teenager. And it was interesting that I did this kind of therapy session with a lady, and I think it's part of a program of some sort. Can't really remember. But I remember her saying to me, you know, name the person who's had the most influence on you. And I said, without hesitating, I said, my mother.
Mm.
And I went, wow, okay, that's kind of weird. And we spoke about that. And I said, I've never met her. I don't know how could she have possibly had an influence on her. And then the more we spoke, the more I realized, to be honest, I was pretty pissed off with her. I was pretty grumpy that she had left. I mean, I would have been a pretty cute little baby. I was 6 months old. And she, you know, how could she possibly, you know, go away? My parents had left us with this lady up the road and had gone. And then, you know, as we talked about it more, it was really interesting because this lady's therapist was saying, okay, so let's think about it. So your mum was 17, unmarried, with two children in Perth, or in Melbourne, actually. Sorry, in Melbourne at that time. And she'd been, her family had disowned her because she'd, had children out of wedlock, you know, 1960s Australia. She was in a relationship with an Italian guy, and that was, you know, that wasn't good. There was a lot of alcohol and booze, which, you know, around, apparently, all this kind of stuff. And so do you think that her leaving you with this old lady was an act of neglect, or was it an act of love? That maybe this old lady, who looked for all intensive purposes like Mrs. Doubtfire, maybe she was a better option to bring up these two children, this 6 month old and 18 month old baby, and left. And you know what? It doesn't matter whether that's the truth or not, but that's the truth that I choose to believe. And that's an interesting shift for me, because I have nothing but love for my mother. And I look at, you know, I don't feel bad about her leaving me, you know, even with my father, I don't have any angst or any of that kind of stuff. I just chose not to have him in my life unless he stopped drinking. But I've got to reframe situations rather than keep telling that old broken story about my mother abandoned me, this happened, you know, she's the cause of all my problems, rah, rah. Or, you know, I had business partners that ripped me off, that I wanted to get killed. I had a foster father who was sexually abusing my sister, that I wanted him killed. You know, there was a lot of that stuff. And I think I have a deep understanding and appreciation of the concept of empathy, to a large degree. But it doesn't mean that I lack the strength of character to put an end to a situation that is wrong, in my view, you know, like my father, for example. From my experience at least, when I can look at life through a lens of empathy and understanding and appreciation and kindness and all those kind of things, my life is a whole lot better. Mm. My life is so much better when I do that. And I think it's very easy to let the bitter and twistedness of life that many people experience kind of take over. And I saw that old lady that brought me up for the first 10 years of my life, she was so consumed by anger and hatred and disappointment, and for good reason in many parts, you know. But I saw her over the next 10 years till I was 18 and she died, that this, how that anger and hatred just consumed her physically. I saw that and I'm like, geez, that's what I'm going to become. This angry, twisted, you know, bitter old man, you know. And it was like, wow, I don't want that. So this is really like a therapy session, guys. This is awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, yes.
We love a good therapy Tuesday.
We'll send the bill later.
send me a bill. I hope I'm online with answering your questions.
No, it's perfect. I mean, this is what the series is about, all those different things. One of the things you said earlier, you said, I can't read my own handwriting, but it was something about the competition being only against yourself and not against others. And I wrote next to that the word, so what do you do when those feelings of jealousy crop up? And I think it's going to be a similar answer to this, because we're talking about something very specific and traumatic and personal, deeply personal. But what happens when, you know, you're in business or something else and you see somebody else having that success, or someone's achieving something that maybe you should have, you thought you should have done, and should's a loaded, terrible word.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you kind of combat those smaller feelings, those negative smaller feelings that also hold us back?
I have pangs of them, without a doubt. I mean, there's times, you know, as an author, you'd like to sell, you know, 100 million books. I'd like to be J.K. Rowling. I'd like to, not really for the money, but just because you'd like to think that you had that many books in other people's hands. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever going to make a movie out of 101 ways to market your business.
We could try.
I think. But I've really worked hard at building up my business and I guess my life to have the life that I want, you know, and what is important to me. And I think the challenge is often that a lot of people feel that they need to build a business that others expect them to build, you know. And that can be where other people expect them to build a giant business or a big tech startup that they sell for $1 billion, or, you know, to build a law firm or to build this or build that. But it's not really what they want to do, you know, yet they feel that there's an obligation to build something because that's what others expect of them. And so I guess, you know, every right back from that, one of those kind of sliding doors moments when I turned left instead of turning right, you know, it's been very much for me to make sure that I kind of live life to the beat of my own drum. And a big part of that is learning how to be, to love other people's success and not to be comparing my own level of success with that. And to go, I don't want to build an empire. I never wanted to build an empire. I love people that do. We need Bill Gateses of the world, or Steve Jobs, or you know, whoever it might be, kind of doing that stuff. But that's not what I want. And so I guess what's important for me is my privacy, is my freedom, is the ability to go and chase wombats in the middle of Flinders Island three or four times a year, the you know, to be able to do meaningful work. I guess I'm just really clear about what all of that really means to me, what it really looks like for me. And so when you kind of got all, and I built a business that gives me all of that, I don't really feel there's a lot to be jealous about, you know, with others. I don't really kind of feel that. I'm just actually incredibly grateful for what I have and what I've built. And I forget at times that it's, you know, it took me a long time to build this. I spent, you know, many years building the ideal business for me, you know, not for everyone else, but for me. And I guess that kind of changes your perception and perspective on other people and other people's success and even other people's failings, you know. It breaks my heart to see someone that doesn't succeed, you know, because I know that how much pain there is in that, and I know how hard that is to live with, and you know, all that's gone behind it. You know, small business isn't where it was, you know, up the street you see a closed sign, and I know generally what's behind that. You know, there's probably health breakdown, probably a relationship breakdown, probably a loss of a house and all the rest of it, and yet I think a lot of people just see, oh, it's an empty shop, there'll be a new one there in a couple of weeks' time, and go, wow, I see a lot more. So I guess I've learned to be very empathetic over the years. I think it's a really important life skill.
Yeah.
Is the best form of competition one that supports the competitors in some way?
Well, probably. you know, you know, probably. I don't know, you know, I do encounter a lot of people who are, they reach a stage and they almost become bitter and twisted because they haven't achieved a degree of success that they feel is deserved. And I see that slide. It's a slippery slide where you know, I don't know. I don't think it necessarily brings out the niceness in people. But you're right, you know, sometimes it's the competitive nature that spurs people on. You know, there's no doubt about that, right? In physical activities and all kinds of things. I think in business, I don't know. For me personally, it's the competitiveness. I'm just happier with being competitive against myself. I think that's kind of what works for me, more than needing to sell more, you know, build a bigger business, I don't know, than other people.
What are the personal values that you hold dear to you? Do you mind sharing?
No, not at all. I have my own little kind of framework that I have, and I kind of carry it around with me.
I love it.
Where I've got my own little 10 frameworks for that, and I just kind of, let me just bring them up. Simply again, because of that whole concept of what are my values to live for, it was so good for me to really have it in a visual format so that I can use it. And I share it often. And it's about being wise, you know, and in that to me is about, you know, the grayness of life and being slower to judge and learning, you know, from my experiences in life. So I try to be wiser as I get older. Be kind is very important to me, that kindness. You know, I remember people that were really kind to me when I was younger in a very difficult space that had a profound effect on my life. And they were kind just to be kind, not because of any other reason. Be present. I think we live in such a distracted world. I really pride myself in being fully present and full, whatever I'm doing, I'm there 100%. And I really make the most of situations and engagements. Like my partner, she laughs wherever we go. Everyone knows me, you know, not because I'm a famous writer. They know me because I talk to everyone. I say hello to people. I wander around the markets and everyone comes up and gives me something, some fruit or this or that. Everyone knows me. And it's because I'm fully present when I engage with people. Be understanding, that whole concept of put yourself in the shoes of others is a great value that I love to live by. Be connected. And that value is again about, you know, staying connected with those, you know, in my life that mean a lot to me, and making sure that I'm, you know, I'm there for them when they need me. Be strong. And what I mean by that is be able to make those strong calls, those strong decisions, you know, do the stuff that's hard that I don't want to do, but I need to be strong. Be curious, which we've spoken about. Be better. That whole concept of how can I keep getting better at what it is that I'm doing. And like at 55, I feel like I'm only just beginning in my journey of what I'm doing. So be better is always there. Be natural. And what I mean by that is embrace nature. Nature is a big part of my life. And I love going to wild places and seeing, you know, wild animals. And my big fascination and curiosity is about all things living. And I immerse myself in that a great deal. And the last one is a funny one. It's called La La Love. And I have a little dog who's this total unconditional love. Yeah. And she reminds me about this joy of unconditional love. And so they're my 10 values. And you know, again, I don't worry that some of them might go, it's a bit corny or it's this or not. They're my things that I try and live my life to. And just even having them written out like that in a little document just, I don't know, just kind of helps keep me on track.
You can find out more about Andrew Griffiths and his services at andrewgriffiths.com.au. And his book, Someone Has to Be the Most Expensive, So Why Not Make It You, is available in all the regular places. Also, check out our show notes.
Next time on Reframe of Mind, we have a look at recognising your value and values, because feeling worthy is an ongoing process. Hugh Kearns from Flinders University joins us to discuss how we validate ourselves through positive feedback.
Here's a little secret you can tell your family as well, or anyone. When anybody ever asks you for feedback, they probably don't want feedback at all. They just want someone to tell you that you were right.
This is a
little relationship tip you learn early on in life. You know, when your partner asks, you know, what do you really think? That's not what they mean.
You've been hearing our story. Now we really want to hear yours.
Connect with @ReframeOfMind on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
Or connect with @WelcomeChangeMedia on LinkedIn.
You can also contact us via reframeofmind.com.au with your stories or suggestions for future topics.
We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. And for more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.